Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. Peace in the Middle East is in everyone's interest, says our distinguished guest, former Ambassador Martin Indyk. He twice served as United States Ambassador to Israel during the Clinton administration and briefly under George W. Bush. Focused on the future, Ambassador Indyk revisited his experiences in Innocent Abroad, an intimate account of American peace diplomacy in the Middle East. To America's pro-Israel lobby, Ambassador Indyk says the best way to secure Israel is to secure peace. And he says both the region and the world are ready.
There is a broad consensus across the world now that we have to resolve this conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, and there is a solution. That is to say, an independent Palestinian state, viable, contiguous, in the West Bank and Gaza, living alongside a Jewish state of Israel in peace. And Shimon Peres says, we all know the light at the end of the tunnel. The problem is we don't have a tunnel. The problem is how do we get there? And we have to harness that intention. You know, there are 23 Arab states who have signed up to ending the conflict with Israel through the Arab League Peace Initiative. And now there's like, I think it's 56 Muslim countries, including the Arab states, who are also signed on to this peace initiative. People are kind of exhausted by this conflict. They need to see an end to it. They can see that it's Al-Qaeda and it's Hamas and it's Hezbollah and it's Ahmadinejad who are gaining from this conflict. And everybody else is losing. So people would like to see it finished. But the heart of the problem here is that Palestinians and Israelis, while they believe in a two-state solution, they don't believe it's possible anymore. And Barack Obama's critical challenge is to convince Israelis and Palestinians, the people, that it can still work and reinstill some hope in the minds of the people that, in fact, making peace is going to secure their futures better than continuing with this bloody conflict.
Retired Ambassador Martin Indyk is now director of the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. In Innocent Abroad, he details and critiques the sweep of U.S. policy in the Middle East, which he helped develop and implement. Ambassador Indyk was born in England and educated in Australia before making the U.S. his home in the early 1980s. With experience at the highest levels of government, he is one of the United States' top diplomats. Bill Russell and I share Ambassador Indyk's conclusion that innocence, like ignorance, is not bliss, especially in international relations. And we entered this conversation confident there's much to be learned from experience. Ambassador Martin Indyk, I was reading Innocent Abroad when I called a friend of mine who is a news junkie. And he said, Paul, I can't talk right now. I said, are you all right, Stephen? And he said, oh, I'm all right, but the news is on. And I said, oh, okay. And I got off the phone thinking, well, he's going to know about current events, but he's not going to know what's happening. Am I right?
Well, you need some context, that's for sure. Especially when you're dealing with the part of the world that I've had to deal with in the Middle East.
The Middle East is the perfect example of that, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. Because it is so different to what we in the United States have as the American experience. And it is, a history that goes back to biblical times, of course, and before that, but it is the crucible of the three great faiths and religions. It has a really deep history and culture and values that have developed there that aren't like ours. And yet, when we look at the world, and that's why I titled this book, Innocent Abroad, is that we look at it with this kind of innocence. We tend to assume that everybody's like us and wants to be like us if they're not.
I got the feeling, as, again, reading, this is a riveting story. This is really 4,000 years or 40. I got the feeling that we had this really nice big kid who was kind of klutzy, who was playing tic-tac-toe against grandmaster chess players, and a lot of them, each of whom had a different game in mind.
Correct. Yeah, that's correct. I don't think Bill Clinton was klutzy, but he.
I'm in America, but you could America, you could assign part. No, America being just kind of. Yeah. Oh, is there
it's great, and we the can do, as you say.
It's very true in the sense that we are this overwhelming force. You know, I'm not just talking about militarily, but overall, we are the superpower, and that's especially been the case since the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, in the days when the Soviet Union was around, the Middle East was a point of superpower competition between the United States and the Soviet Union. And the game that was played there at that time was everybody was playing off the two superpowers, off against each other.
Well, with some
changed.
Success.
Indeed, with great success. The game changed when the Soviet Union collapsed and we were the dominant superpower. And then, you know, we went in there and booted Saddam Hussein's army out of Kuwait. And now we were the dominant military power in the region as well. And so suddenly we had the ability to do things that we didn't have before. During the Cold War, we were trying to play what's referred to as a balance of power game. We were trying to balance the Soviet Union and its proxies in the region. And it was the era of Henry Kissinger, realpolitik. And not just him. I mean, it goes back all the way to to Eisenhower after the war. Suddenly, we don't have to play a balance of power game anymore. We're dominant. And so our presidents, Clinton and Bush after him, in very different ways, but still had the same idea that we can now transform this troubled region. We can sally forth into the bazaars of the Middle East and make it over in our own image. Clinton's case is a more peaceful place. In Bush's case, is a more democratic place. But in both cases, more like us.
And the people on the street were all waiting for it.
Right. Well, that's exactly right, because they've seen great powers come and go for centuries. For centuries, from, you know, all the way back to Alexander the Great, Napoleon, the Ottoman Turks, the British, the French. Now come the Americans. Except we came with a naivete that the others did not. The others failed too. But in some ways, it was the goodness of our desire to help out here that was exploited.
I have to say that we were in Egypt in 1999 and were met at the airport by our guide. And
Egyptologist.
Our Egyptologist. And he said, understand you're having this neat little celebration of you know, the millennium, 2,000 years. And
he was a delightful, funny guy.
Funny guy. Yasser. And he said, that's cute. we're at five and counting.
Right. Well, indeed, Egypt is an ancient civilization.
Well, and you mentioned... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, no, but I was going to say, apropos of the millennium, I was Assistant Secretary of State at that moment, in charge of the whole Middle East, and so we were worried about what would happen if the computers shut down. You remember the big scare. And so we had to have all our embassies report on what the computer situation was in each of these countries. And we were very worried about the water system in Syria, in Damascus in particular. And the embassy reported back then, they don't have a 2K problem. They don't even have a 1K problem.
They don't have a K problem.
They have a 7K problem. We're going to be back in just a moment with Ambassador Martin Indyk. Please be with us when we return. Ambassador Martin Indyk has honored us with his presence.
Thank you.
I, Paula Gordon, Bill Russell. You were saying you were Assistant Secretary of State at that point. You're right in the middle of this story, and yet you also are able to establish a kind of a distance. And one of the things I admired was, here is a gentleman who comes from Australia. So you're of us, but not of us. You're of us, but not from us. How does that go? And you're deeply committed to helping us help ourselves and help the world. Where does that come from?
Well, I'm an American. I mean, I chose to be an American. But I think growing up in Australia, I had a different, not just a different accent, but a different perspective. Because Australia was this kind of outpost of the Western world in an Asian sea, and exists in a kind of strategic environment.
And it's a direct product of colonialism.
Indeed. But I had, I think, a distance There's a different perspective on America's role in the world. I greatly admired America's role in the world. That's why I came here. I migrated here. I chose to be an American. I wanted to be part of that, to try to influence in a positive way what happens in the Middle East. But I think that I had a slightly different perspective. The book itself, I didn't want it to be a biography. In effect, I was not the central player there. It was Bill Clinton and all the other actors in the Middle East and the secretaries of state and so on. But I was in the room. I was, you know, working it. I was developing the ideas of policy. And so I had a front row seat. And I tried to write it in that way. It's kind of being, in many ways, the fly on the wall, but also in some ways participating in trying to make things happen.
When you were in graduate school, you had a portrait on your door, which I think is part of this equation. Yeah. Who was it that had this honored position, and why did they have that position?
Anwar Sadat. I was greatly impressed with his statesmanship. I had started this, my personal quest to help make peace in the Middle East, back in 1973, when the Yom Kippur War broke out. I was in Jerusalem. And Anwar Sadat was responsible for launching that surprise attack on Israel. And yet, I was already very interested in international relations, and I was very much aware that he had tried, before making war, he had tried to make peace. He had sent these messages to Israel publicly that he wanted to make peace. And then he increasingly expressed his frustration that he wasn't getting any response. And so I really felt, when the war broke out, that this was an unnecessary war. I wrote an angry letter to Golda Meir, who was prime minister at the time of Israel. I was just a student, but I was just so upset about it, that here was a war that didn't need to take place if she had been willing to take Sadat seriously. And then, I mean, as it went on, he then, you know, he turned, stopped the war as soon as Henry Kissinger engaged and negotiated a ceasefire, and then it became very clear that he wanted to make peace. He wanted to use the war as a platform for making peace. And he worked on that with Kissinger, and they had the disengagement agreements. Then Jimmy Carter comes along, determined to make peace. But again, the naivete kicks in. And he goes running after the Syrians because he wants to have a comprehensive solution. And Sadat wants to make peace. He's not going to let the Syrians veto it. And he stands up one day and says, I'm ready to go to the ends of the earth. I'm ready to go to Jerusalem to make peace. And it was in many ways an impatience with Carter, a desire to divert the United States from that effort to the effort that he cared about, which was to make the deal with Menachem Begin, and they'd had some secret negotiations. And, you know, and Carter swung around to his credit, and there wouldn't have been a peace treaty without Jimmy Carter there. But so for me, watching all of this from my perch as a student, a PhD student, and then as an academic, it was Sadat that was the man who drove the process of peace from its early days after the 73 war. And it was that statesmanship that is so missing in the Middle East, and yet unexpectedly it will emerge from one or other of the leaders. A Sadat, a Rabin will come along, a King Hussein, and at those moments we can actually make peace.
And Assad in his own way, and if we don't recognize those moments...
Right.
There is... Years ago, somebody made a comment. I was at an event, and it was during the Bush years. It said, you know, this was bordering on an argument that, of course, this country was founded on the church and a religious perspective and something and something. And I said, I don't think so. But, you know, I went back and checked the Constitution, read a little more history, you know, scratched. And basically, this country was founded in the Enlightenment. Its history, its logic, the people who, so-called founding fathers, were all deeply influenced by the English Enlightenment, not much less than the Continental Enlightenment. But, we talk about naivete, and that there's a lot of that going on, but there's also a fundamentally different worldview, that if your founding mythology is predicated on the Enlightenment, which looks to reason, which looks to logic, which gets us to this we can solve anything mindset, because it's essentially, unfortunately, it's the Newtonian clockwork universe.
Mm-hmm.
And all you got to do is take apart the pieces and reassemble the pieces and live happily ever after. And I say that as you're talking about these bursts of opportunity.
Yeah.
It seems as if, and this really is a question, it seems as if we go in with the idea that we can take the clock apart and reassemble the clock and we'll all live happily ever after. When in fact you're dealing with rich cultural, non-rational or extra-rational. That's not to say these people are any more irrational than we are. Some of the stories you tell suggest that, you know, we've got a long way to go ourselves in that area.
Mm-hmm.
But that if we are not flexible, if we're not adaptive, if we're not listening, if we don't have a sense of the history, and if we also are not flexible and willing to change our directions, willing to change our goals, then, and this matters because we're, you know, it's still broken, and in some ways more broken even than the period you're talking about. And we, I don't, fix it is not the right word, but we do have to live with it.
Yeah, but you see, you said it better than I could say it. I think that's exactly the nature of the encounter between the United States and the Middle East is fraught for precisely the reasons that you've explained here. Our different histories, a different culture, and they have a very deep and rich history. But their politics are different to ours, and their, as you say, their way of thinking is different. Now, Israel is a kind of exception. Israel,
which is part of the problem, probably.
Mold. And it's interesting you talked about the Newtonian clock. Ehud Barak, when he was Prime Minister of Israel, was very much focused on the clockwork. He actually, as a hobby, dismantled and reassembled clocks. Seriously, and the timing was everything to him. And he committed the same error, he operated on the same false assumption. You know, Osama bin Laden is credited with this saying. I don't know whether he said it, but it's a good line. It captures it. He said, "You Americans have the watches, but we have the time." And that's the critical difference. Time moves a lot more slowly in that part of the world. You got leaders there, authoritarian leaders, who have no term limits except the term of their natural lives. And they're not in a hurry by nature. We are in a hurry. We're a society that's in a terrible hurry. That's how come we invented fast food. You know?
And it's terrible.
Right. It's quintessentially American.
Yeah.
Right? We want change. We want it to come quickly and we're impatient. And they have all the patience in the world.
Well,
except there are those moments when suddenly these leaders feel that their throne is threatened, their people are restless, that they've got to do something. And that's the moment when their clock speeds up. And that's the moment when we can actually affect the change to a more peaceful, more democratic place.
And yet we've been tone deaf to that.
Exactly. We are tone deaf to it because, you know, it's very hard for us to accept that their clock is different.
Or that they might know something we don't know?
Indeed. But their experience is different. The way they react to things is different to the way we do. You know, it's one of the things that struck me as we were doing this, it's not just our innocence. There's also an arrogance of assuming that they want to be like us. There's also an ignorance of their ways, of their history. And it's kind of willful on our part. You know, I had certainly studied the region, but when it came to actually making peace, when we had to, you know, for example, go to Camp David and try to write a peace treaty that would end the conflict between the Israelis and Palestinians. We weren't prepared for that. We didn't. We hadn't done the study of it. We hadn't prepared all the research on Jerusalem, for instance. It was the first time we actually started to negotiate Jerusalem. And we were, you know, basically ignorant of all of the depths of these issues.
How can
Why did
that
we do
be?
That? Why did we do that? You know, it's not as if we didn't have intelligence agencies and we didn't have capabilities or so on. I'm talking about myself here, you know. But our team, we didn't do that kind of homework. And how can it be? Because, as you said, you know, we thought, well, hell, we'll just, you know, we'll come up with the solution. We thought we could, you know, the perfect example is we thought we could divide sovereignty in the holy sites in Jerusalem. Because, you know, here, the Temple Mount, where the ruins of the Jewish temple 2,000 years ago are believed to be located, and therefore it is the holiest site in Judaism. Well, on top of that, it's called the Haram al-Sharif, is where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is, third holiest place in Islam, right? They are, in effect, the same place.
And Jesus was born down the street.
And down the road, yeah. No, he wasn't. He was born
a few miles out. Yeah.
But he was crucified there, or believed to have been crucified
and there. And Gethsemane is there.
And buried there, you know. And so here you have in this little area a place of immense importance to people of faith all over the world, Jews, Muslims, and Christians. And we come in and we think, oh, okay, let's divide it. We'll give the Palestinian sovereignty on the surface and we'll give the Israeli sovereignty on the wall, and everybody will see that that's an obviously rational solution.
No. Ambassador Martin Indyk will tell us just how wrong we were when we return in just a moment with him, Bill Russell. I'm Paula Gordon. We hope you will be with us as well. We're delighted to be with Ambassador Martin Indyk, who is the former United States Ambassador to Israel.
May I put in a plug before you?
Please do. I hope that the plug is for Innocent Abroad.
It is. And one of the challenges with a book like this is typically it is an exercise in making oneself look good.
Mm. Or covering the tracks of
or
the
covering
the
various parts of the anatomy that are exposed, have been exposed, or justifying or rationalizing it. And if you did that, I can't find it. You were, I think, remarkably candid about, you know, without being nasty about it, but very candid about the kinds of mistakes that you made, that the Americans made, that the Palestinians made, that the Egyptians, everybody has a piece of this. Everybody has a piece of it. And your willingness to, you know, from a distance, to go back through, you know, work through your records, think about it, and as you say, you'd intended to write this book from the beginning. Mm. So this is a very conscious process. But as an honest perspective from one person's very rich experience, it's a remarkable tool for understanding the Middle East to some extent, but also human failings, human challenges, and the opportunities to overcome those. Yeah. So that's a long way around saying thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. You know, I tried to write the book in that way, but the reason that I did that was because I felt a very personal responsibility for what went wrong.
Oh.
You know, I mean, we started at the beginning of the Clinton administration. There I was as Bill Clinton, the president's Middle East advisor. And we set out to make comprehensive peace, to end the Arab-Israeli conflict. And for a while there, it really looked as if we were going to do it. For the first 2 years, everything was kind of fitting into place, not the place that we expected it to. We were trying to make peace with Syria, and like Sadat and Carter, you know, Rabin went off and made peace with the Palestinians, but okay, we adjusted and got behind it. Then we had an Israel-Jordan peace treaty, and then Rabin was assassinated. The whole process cratered, and then finally Barak was elected, and we tried again. We had a second chance, and the whole process cratered again, and ended up, instead of comprehensive peace, we ended up with what looked like comprehensive war. I mean, the Israelis and Palestinians at the end of the Clinton administration, were killing each other instead of talking about living together. And
so it
was a real tragedy from my point of view.
Well, at one point.
And I felt, you know, that since I was involved in, I had some responsibility to try to be as honest as possible, because I knew somehow, there would be a time would come again when a new president would set forth and try to make peace again. I had no idea it was going to be Barack Obama on day two, announcing that that's what he intended to do. But I felt at least obliged to try to discern the lessons from our experience, so that as a kind of lantern on the stern, so that he and his advisors, including Hillary Clinton, of course, would have some kind of guide to the... They'll make their own mistakes, but at least they can avoid the mistakes that were made by Clinton and Bush.
Is there no institutional memory at all in our foreign policy?
Well, it's an interesting question, because basically when George W. Bush came in to office, he did not want to have anything to do with the peace process. His general attitude was, we used to joke, ABC, anything but Clinton. But in particular, he had this view that what Clinton and his peace team had done in the Middle East was stupid and feckless, and he wasn't going to do that. I recount in this book this meeting that I had with him. The only time I met with him, I was his ambassador for the first 6 months. I stayed on in Israel at his request, and I came back with Ariel Sharon, the newly elected prime minister, for his first meeting with the president. And after Sharon left the Oval Office, he asked me to stay behind. And he said to me, what went wrong? And I said, well, there's a lot of blame to go around, Mr. President, but essentially it was a lack of leadership. And before I had the chance to elaborate, he stopped me. He's famous for not being a very curious man. And he said, that's right. No leadership. Barack and Clinton were two desperate men chasing after Yasser Arafat. They made him a generous offer. Arafat rejected it and resorted to violence. And now Sharon is prime minister. He's not going to offer what Barack offered and Arafat already rejected. So there's no Nobel Peace Prize to be made here, to be reached here. And that was it. And he said goodbye. So he summed it up.
For the next 7 years.
He was right. But his prescription was wrong. His analysis was right, but his prescription was wrong. Well, which is to say, you walk away from it.
Well, it's a comic book.
In terms of the institutional memory, what he did was he dismissed anybody who had anything to do with the peace process. You weren't even allowed, in his State Department, you weren't even allowed to use the words peace process. And Colin Powell came out to Israel before this visit. He said to me, I think we're just going to park this problem for a while. And I said to him, you can't park. It's on a steep hill and it doesn't have any brakes. But, that was the attitude.
And you also quote one of the Bush people saying, we don't do diplomacy, we do policy, right. Which to me was the most shocking thing I read in the whole book.
Yeah, but it's true. I mean, eventually they came back to it. Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, started to reintroduce the idea of diplomatic engagement. And in his last year, the president actually launched this Annapolis peace process, but by then so much had been destroyed. And when they came to doing diplomacy, they didn't know how to do diplomacy. They had such disdain for it. So Condoleezza Rice made, 13 trips to the region, but she never tried to set up an objective, have her people prepare the ground, go in there with proposals, get the reactions, try to close the gaps. None of the stuff of diplomacy was done. She just kind of turned up. And that won't do it.
If you don't believe in government and the efficacy of government, presumably that includes diplomatic undertakings. Right. And I go back to the clock. If you live in a clockwork universe, brute force works. If it's not a clockwork universe, yeah. then there is room for diplomacy, mm-hmm. Understanding, psychology, a whole range of different tools that I would assume is part of the tool set of a diplomat.
Exactly. Exactly right. I think, the brute force can shake things up in the Middle East, and there's plenty of history of that. But when that happens, the diplomats have got to come in and seize that moment, because people are more flexible at those moments to try to change the situation for better. The classic example of this in terms of Bush and Rice was the 2006 war in Lebanon, which had been provoked by Hezbollah. Israel responded, didn't really want to go back into Lebanon, but was kind of sucked into this you know, use of force, and of course, it's got a lot more capabilities. Hezbollah was firing the rockets back. And basically, Bush and Rice kind of sat back and let them have at it, which was their default position. And a failure to understand that when you've got a crisis like that, a hot conflict, you need to come in and try to get a ceasefire and re-establish new rules of the game. And eventually she did it, but by that time, it was too late. Same thing in Gaza. Of course, it was the last days of the administration. But we needed to be in there immediately. Look, that last crisis broke out because Hamas wanted to change the rules of the game of the ceasefire, and the Israelis wanted to change it too. And instead of the diplomats getting in there and saying, okay, this is not stable, let's work out a negotiated agreement that will, you know, make it a more stable arrangement. Instead, you know, so that it erupts with this terrible devastation. And again, we needed to be back in there, stopping the fighting and negotiating the ceasefire. But we didn't do that.
It also seems that the opportunity, this is true in lots of different places, and I assume it's true in diplomacy, when things start getting weird, when there's a dynamic, when people start moving off dead center, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's a war mm-hmm. or somebody's health or a succession issue or whatever, once things become that, you know, start moving, then they're in play again. And at that point, you're in a much better position if you're paying attention, if you know that's going on,
right.
if you have the intelligence.
Right.
I mean both kinds of intelligence. then you're in a position to have an effect on where that settles back down again.
Right. Right.
If you sit back and wait for it to happen by the time and wait for it to end, then people are back in their fixed positions.
Exactly.
And nothing's going to change.
Exactly. And then, you know, there's I think the Chinese word for crisis is danger and opportunity. And that's exactly right. And interesting, you know, Henry Kissinger is criticized for many things, especially Vietnam and so on. But in the Middle East, he understood exactly what you said. He understood when that war broke out, which if he'd had his antenna up, he would have known that Sadat was could not abide the status quo. But he didn't. He was off making detente with the Russians, with the Soviet Union. But he saw there was an opportunity, and he did seize it. He got the ceasefire, and he then built a peace process out of it.
The former American ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Martin Indyk, is with us, and we trust you will be with the three of us when we return in just a moment. We are privileged to be with Martin Indyk, who is the former United States ambassador to Israel. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon. Ambassador, you were saying of Henry Kissinger, I am no fan of Henry Kissinger, and he appears to have said something right when he said that Israel, of which we have spoken very little, doesn't do foreign policy, they do domestic politics.
Right.
Did I get that correctly?
Exactly right. Yeah.
The Israeli part of this, it's very easy to say, well, you know, you guys are sounding like you're taking sides. Well, there are positions that need to be understood on all counts, including
yeah.
that of the state of Israel. Mm. And we're now at 60 years since that state was established. The reality is this is hard for everybody. What is it that the Israelis can contribute? You were talking about Gaza. I was thinking before we started, oh, Gaza.
Right.
How is it that we've been unable to take the people that you very clearly say Bill Clinton was arguing as an ally of Israel? How do we, if we are interested with people who genuinely want peace, how do we begin to stake out a place where everybody can have that when those who clearly don't want it and profit from the mayhem are the ones who can kick it all off the road to a better place?
Well, I mean, first of all, we need to be realistic and recognize that Barack Obama looks at the landscape. It's changed for the worse in a lot of dramatic ways compared to when Bill Clinton and I, as his advisor, came in to the White House in 1993. You know, then all the Arab states were at the negotiating table with Israel. As I said, we had dominant influence. The Palestinians were there too. And Rabin had been elected with a mandate to make peace. Now we've got an Israeli election in Israel that's likely to produce a center-right government. The reason for that is that the Israeli people have become quite disillusioned with the idea of peacemaking. I know this is hard for people to understand, but their narrative is that they pulled out unilaterally from Gaza, they dismantled all of those settlements, and what do they get in return? Rocket fire into Israel proper. And so they think, okay, we're going to have a peace process now in which we have to get out of the West Bank, which, by the way, most of them recognize that they don't want to be there, but they sure as hell don't want to repeat the experience of Gaza and have rockets being fired from the West Bank across the border, and it's only a couple of kilometers into Ben Gurion International Airport or the heart of Tel Aviv. So they, on the one hand, I think they will be willing to support a territorial compromise in which the Palestinian state is established in, 95% of the West Bank and all of Gaza, but they're not going to support that unless they know that that territory, when they pull the Israeli army out, is going to be controlled by a responsible, capable partner. And the problem there is that the responsible, capable partner, which was supposed to be the Palestinian Authority, has, through these years of conflict in which the United States stood on the sidelines and watched, has been so disintegrated. Its governing institutions have been so weakened. Its security forces have been, most of them went over to fighting Israel terrorist cadres and so on. They've got to rebuild everything now. And now they've got to do it in Gaza as well.
You talk about setting the environment as the one thing that the United States can do, that we, and then imagine, leave the details to the people who have to live with them. Mm. What's that environment of which you speak?
Well, There's first of all the broad strategic environment in the region, which affects the calculus of the leaders there, and the broad strategic environment is both dangerous and yet it has opportunities. Dangerous because the Iranians are set on acquiring nuclear weapons capability. It certainly seems that way. They are backing Hamas, Hezbollah, that say to the Arab people and beyond to the Muslim world, we have a way to redeem Palestine. It's through violence, terrorism, defiance of the international community. And that context, made even more complicated by Iran's nuclear program, is a very negative one for peacemaking. But at the same time, those Arab leaders who also sat on the sidelines in the 1990s when we were trying to make peace with Arafat, now feel that their situation is becoming quite shaky. They have to show that there's an alternative, that peacemaking under American auspices with Israel can redeem Palestine much more effectively. And so that's... Obama has to, he's going to reach out to the Iranians and try to head off their nuclear program through diplomacy. I think he has to reach out to the Syrians as well, who are interested in making peace with Israel, and bring them into the circle of peace to the extent that's possible. That will put the Iranians in a situation, where the Syrians are allied to them, where they will feel a little nervous about being isolated. They won't feel so much that the wind is at their backs at that point. And if at the same time he's reaching out to the Iranians, he may be able to create a certain symbiosis there, where the Syrians are worried that the Iranians are going to make a deal, the Iranians are worried that the Syrians are going to make a deal, but at the same time we need to be moving on the Palestinian track. So that's what I mean by creating the strategic context.
And you haven't even spoken of the Sunni-Shiite Persian, Arab, right, underlying exactly. predicates, all of which really matter.
Right, exactly right. I mean, you put your finger on it in terms of this conflict now has metastasized. So now it operates on at least three levels between Israelis and Arabs, Israel and Palestinians in particular, between Arabs and Arabs, between the radical Arabs of Hamas and Hezbollah, backed by the Muslim Brotherhood, and the moderate Arabs of King Hussein, King Abdullah of Jordan, and King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, and Hosni Mubarak of Egypt. And then on the Arab-Iranian level, which is also an overlay of a Sunni-Shia conflict. So you know, where do you begin? How do you affect all of those things? But it's to understand you're essentially playing chess on a three-dimensional chessboard.
Delete.
What you do in one area can affect what you do in the other areas in a positive way, not just a negative way.
The late condensed matter physicist Per Bach.
Thank you for that, Bill.
Pointed out that condensed matter physicists live in their own little universe, but he said, you know, physics has reached a point, and this goes to the
excuse me,
clockwork universe. We've reached a point where equations are not enough. We have to do narrative. Mm. And you used the word narrative earlier in describing one perspective, but it seems that
excuse me,
part of the challenge in this is you've got all of these narratives going on, and a narrative they are both fixed, but they're also dynamic. And we, I think Americans, tend to assume that there's a national narrative. And we've created these artificial entities. The British and the French created these entities in the Middle East. And we assume that there is a Syrian perspective, that there is an Iranian perspective, that there's a Jewish perspective, that there... And what you have is, you know, you've got a religious cut across that, and then you've got sects within those religions. You've got a national piece, you have an economic piece, you've got a political piece. There are all these various pieces, and they're all moving all the time. I think three dimensions is...
you should be it's, three
it's,
11
it's,
dimensions.
Yeah, 11 dimensions, just, you know, it's sort of the warm-up for that. But it seems that part of the challenge for anybody who's going to engage is to stay on top of those narratives, which is a non-trivial undertaking. But if we try trivializing it, we can't be effective.
What you have, you know, in a sense, it's a kaleidoscope that if you turn it, it keeps on changing.
Right.
The pattern keeps on changing. But I'm going to mix my metaphors here. It's like a weather forecasting in a way. You've got all all these different currents and highs and lows and it's very hard to predict the weather, except when a dominant front comes in and it rearranges things. And that's what we are here. The United States is...
It's a low-pressure system.
Right.
Or a high-pressure system.
But, so when we come in with, you know, here's Barack Obama coming in wanting to make peace, wanting to reach out to the Iranians and I think also bring the Syrians in, wanting to draw down our forces in Iraq. So it's an immensely complicated effort, but we are acting. We're not sitting back and just watching this. We are now engaged in a very aggressive is the wrong word, but activist way. And everybody is going to make their own calculations about how to respond to this. And that's where, as you say, stay on top of the narratives. We have to stay very carefully attuned to what they're saying to us. I love the way that Obama said in that first interview he gave, you know, we want to listen and not just talk. I mean, George W. Bush was really focused on, you know, this message of his was, it's our way or the highway. It's, you know, you're with us or against us. Obama wants to send a very different message. That's really important. And you see how he shakes things up. The Iranian leader, Ahmadinejad, who made his reputation on railing against the United States, suddenly saying, well, maybe we should talk to the United States. I don't trust him at all, but it's an example of the way in which these guys over there have to think, okay, now how am I going to deal with this superpower when it's coming in actively? Bibi Netanyahu, right? He may be the next prime minister of Israel.
Yeah,
he's got to figure, okay, Obama wants to make peace. Now, my politics, as you were saying, my politics are not going to allow me to make concessions, on territorial concessions on the West Bank. I've got to find a way to deal with this superpower. The Israeli people are going to punish me if I don't manage Obama effectively. So what am I going to do? My guess? You go off and make peace with the Syrians.
And a good guess it may well be, coming from a former United States ambassador to Israel, Martin Indyk, who will be with us when we return in just a moment. We're delighted to be with former Ambassador Martin Indyk, who represented the United States in Israel for a number of years in the Clinton administration, as he also worked in the State Department per se, both as ambassador and as an Undersecretary of State. Bill Russell, I think I interrupted you.
I was, there's a section in there on Iran that I found particularly interesting. And I think it was in the context of the Iranians stepping back and looking at the Clinton policy and figuring out how they were going to deal with the Clinton policy. I think part of the mistake we make is we assume that we're smarter than everybody else and they're going to behave according to plan. But they, in at that period, given the circumstances, were looking at the divisions between Europe and the United States. And at the problems that peace with any of the other players in there would present for them. Well, if either of those, seeing that and understanding that and knowing that the American publicly were saying this is our focus, being relatively clever people, they sat back and figured out how to counter that.
Right.
They're very clever people. All of these are very clever people, and we treat them as if they are just pawns rather than kings and queens and bishops and knights.
Yeah, it's not just that they're clever, but they've had a lot of experience dealing with outside powers. The Middle East is geostrategically located, so that it's always been a territory contested by superpowers or great powers throughout history. And so they have it in their genes. They know how to deal with us, how to divert us, how to resist us. Or how to turn our power to their purpose. And the Iranians, because they too live in a strategic environment, you know, they've got Pakistan and Afghanistan on one border, they've got Iraq on the other, the Russians up to the north, and then there's the United States and Europe. So, I mean, they're looking out at the world and they're figuring out how they're going to survive. And exactly as you said, we announce them. This was, you know, my strategic genius, you know, you know, we were going to make comprehensive peace between the Israelis and the Arabs. That was our first objective. And our second objective in parallel was we were going to isolate Iran and isolate Syria. We called it, isolate Iraq. We called it the dual containment strategy. It was a strategy with two branches. Contain the Iraqi rogue Saddam Hussein and the Iranian revolutionary mullahs, and make peace between Israel and the Arabs. And the Iranians looked at this and said, okay, if he's trying to make peace and isolate us, the best way to stop them from succeeding isolating us is to stop them from making peace. And they used their proxies, particularly Hezbollah at that time and Palestine Islamic Jihad, to disrupt the whole peace process. Now, I believe, and I recount this story in the book, that they were responsible more than anybody else for the defeat of Shimon Peres after Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated and the rise of Bibi Netanyahu. I think it worked much more successfully than they imagined, but they used Hezbollah rocket fire into Israel to provoke an Israeli attack, which then cost him the Arab vote, and that was the end of him. And the end of the peace process for that time. What the lesson from this is, I think, exactly what Obama seems to be starting to do, which is, yes, to seek comprehensive peace, to try to draw the Syrians into the peace process, but to understand that that is deeply threatening to the Iranians, and not to say to the Iranians, we're going to isolate you, but to say exactly what he said, if you unclench your fist, we'll meet you with an open hand. So to tell the Iranians, we're not trying to isolate you, we're willing to have you be a partner in this effort to construct a more peaceful order in the Middle East, but it's your choice. If you want to continue on the way of Ahmadinejad, then you have chosen to isolate yourself. It's not us that's isolating. And I think that's a critically important approach.
It seems that they're There are two senses in which trust matters in this. There's the trust that if you say you'll do something, you'll do it. Mm. And that that there is a mutuality, that we're operating on the same value scale. There's also, I think, a trust that is, in this context, much more important, which is what you would like to have from your intelligence agencies. It's part of understanding these narratives. Mm. Not, you know, it's not that I have trust you to do what you say you will do. It is I know enough about you to be able to understand where you are likely to go, that your behavior is not absolutely predictable, but it is, you know, we can within plus or minus 10 degrees, as an example, in this domain, be pretty confident right. that this is the behavior. And it seems to me that's the kind of trust mm-hmm. that we need to be developing, mm-hmm. which is largely an exercise. Again, this goes back to understanding the narratives and having good intelligence.
Yes, but here's the challenge with the Iranians. We haven't been talking to them for 30 years on any official level, you know, and
much less listening.
Right. We don't have a feel for them. They don't have a feel for us either, by the way.
Isn't there a lesson in that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. What Nick Burns, who was the Undersecretary for Policy and responsible for Iran in the Bush administration, did was to understand that we didn't have a feel for that. And he took what we had in my time. We had one person working on Iran, and he built that Iran desk into, I think there are now 28 people working on it. And we have in embassies in key areas around the Middle East, diplomats who are responsible for reporting on Iran, talking to Iranians who come out of Iran, and so on. Hopefully we'll set up an interest section there. The Iranians have an interest section in Washington already, so that we can start to get that feel for them. But you're right. Listening is critically important because you then pick up the nuances. You build trust because if people feel that you're listening to them. But you also hear what they're saying. If you start to listen to what their problem is, this was a true lesson for me in negotiations. And it was actually when I was dealing with the Israelis, was to sit down and try to draw them out, try to get them to explain what their problem was with what we were trying to get them to do. Because then you can try to be creative in finding ways to answer their problems. But if you're not talking to them, you can't possibly hear that. And so that's why engaging with the Iranians becomes so important. Sit down with them and try to understand where they're coming from. Because obviously we're not going to give up our interests. We cannot accept a nuclear Iran without terrible consequences for the whole region. So we have to understand this. Why do they want nuclear weapons? What is it that's driving them? What is the insecurity there? And can we find a way to treat that insecurity so that they don't need nuclear weapons?
Former Ambassador, United States Ambassador to Israel, Martin Indyk. We'll all three be back in a moment for a couple more minutes. Be with us. Ambassador Martin Indyk, I. Paula Gordon, Bill Russell. It's always interesting to me. I've always been interested in the idea of international relations, but that sounds big. A lot of this is one person with another person, and the individuality of this also really matters, doesn't it? Who those players are?
Yeah. You know, when you look back at where breakthroughs to peace were achieved, the leadership was very important. What I've also discovered is that, you know, people-to-people relations are very important too, at the ground level. But without the leaders, it's incredibly difficult to change the environment. And so we need those leaders. And where you had them, where you had Sadat and Begin and Carter, you could achieve peace. Hussein, Rabin, Clinton, you could achieve peace. Arafat and Rabin were, you know, with Clinton, were on their way. But Arafat had some fatal flaws that, and of course, Rabin was assassinated. Rabin understood how to deal with Arafat. He understood how to move him in the right direction. With Rabin's assassination, we lost that relationship of trust that had been built up over the previous years, and Barak never managed to establish it with him.
You say that let's see if I can get this correctly, the Palestinians must have justice and the Arabs must have respect. Mm. What then must the Israelis have?
Security and recognition. That's the heart of the matter for the Israelis, is this acceptance by their neighbors that they're willing to accept a Jewish state in the midst of the Middle East, and that when they take risks for peace, evacuate Arab territory, and make peace, that those which have security arrangements in them, that those agreements will be respected in a way that Israel will have a secure peace, and that is, I think, critical here. In many ways, you know, to be an effective diplomat, you need to be a psychiatrist. There are a lot of traumas, personality disorders. I think Arafat was a narcissist, basically. But in the Israeli case, it's a deep insecurity that's generated by thousands of years of experience of oppression and you know, in each generation, somebody rising to kill the Jews.
I would like to
destroy Israel.
Take a minute. You're talking about, you know, we've been talking about government-to-government relations. There is a role in this, it would seem, because you were talking about the importance of people-to-people. But NGOs, you know, some of the organizations that you've worked with and working with now.
Non-governmental organizations.
It seems to me that that's also part of the equation, and that there is opportunity and danger in the role those organizations play, both as, you know, as both from a positive standpoint, but also the potential for, you know, lobbying that is inappropriate lobbying from any side. But how do you put that into the equation? The role of NGOs.
Yeah, it's very important. Clearly, as I say, peace can be made between leaders, but it has to be supported by the people on both sides. And there's a great deal of distrust and anger, and part of the problem here is that, you know, it's one thing to move from war to peace, but it's another thing to go move from war to peace and back to war. Getting back to peace again is really difficult. So again, you have to shape the environment in which these NGOs can operate effectively in building a culture of peace.
Both there and in places like the United States.
Well, in the United States, what's critical is that those who have an interest, the Arab American community, the American Jewish community, need to mobilize in support of ending this conflict instead of dividing and basically supporting, you know, the hardliners on both sides. And you know, when Arafat and Rabin shook hands on the White House lawn that afternoon, we brought together those two communities and all of their NGO organizations in the White House. President Clinton addressed them. It was an amazing moment in which Americans, Arabs and Jews, reached across the aisle in a similar way and talked about how they were going to work together. And somehow we have to recreate that sense of common purpose here. In the Jewish community, and I experienced this as an American Jew, it was a very hard experience for me. After those years of trying to work to achieve peace, Jewish community here, the leadership at least, concluded, you know, it was a fraud, it was a mistake to trust Arafat, and it was better to support George Bush when he walked away from it, and that American engagement meant pressure on Israel, that would be bad, and they're much better to let Sharon deal with it in his own way. And it was, I think, a misunderstanding of what Israel needed in terms of its objectives of survival, its well-being, peace, its security, cannot be achieved just by force alone, as we just saw in Gaza. That there needs to be a diplomatic effort to resolve the conflict, and it can't succeed without American engagement.
On all levels.
So therefore, it's pro-Israel for an American president to be involved. It's not against Israel. It's in order to help Israel achieve peace. And I think it's really important that, you know, you talk about NGOs. I know it's a code word here. We're talking about APEC. We're talking about...
I really wasn't, but certainly it's there.
All right, we're to the pro-Israel lobby. I think needs to get behind Barack Obama. It needs to feel secure that he's going to do the right thing by Israel. And that if, you know, if it doesn't work, he's going to be in the trenches with Israel. And I think he understands that. But they need to understand that it's time to get behind that effort. Because if their interest is to secure Israel, this is the best way to achieve it.
Isn't that the world's interest?
Well, increasingly, I mean, that's an interesting point, you know, that there is a broad consensus across the world now that we have to resolve this conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, and there is a solution. That is to say, an independent Palestinian state, viable, contiguous, in the West Bank and Gaza, living alongside a Jewish state of Israel in peace. And Shimon Peres says, you know, we all know the light at the end of the tunnel. The problem is we don't have a tunnel. The problem is how do we get there? And we have to harness that intention. You know, there are 23 Arab states who have signed up to ending the conflict with Israel through the Arab League Peace Initiative. And now there's like, I think it's 56 Muslim countries, including the Arab states, who are also signed on to this peace initiative. People are kind of exhausted by this conflict. They need to see an end to it. They can see that it's, you know, it's Al-Qaeda and it's Hamas and it's Hezbollah and it's Ahmadinejad who are gaining from this conflict. And everybody else is losing. So people would like to see it finished. But the heart of the problem here is that Palestinians and Israelis, while they believe in a two-state solution, they don't believe it's possible anymore. And Barack Obama's critical challenge is to convince Israelis and Palestinians, the people, that it can still work and reinstill some hope in the minds of the people that, in fact, making peace is going to secure their futures better than continuing with this bloody conflict.
Thank you for beginning the process that we hope will come to a real fruition in the years ahead.
I hope so too.
Martin Indyk is as engaging in his book Innocent Abroad as he is in conversation. His even-handed candor is refreshing, and his commitment to finding ways to peace is itself a cause for optimism. We thank him for the book, and we thank him for joining us. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.